Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Today it's Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Hi, Mark.
Good morning.
So the winds have been whipping the last couple of days. Last night, we were watching the birds out the window, watching them kind of like get, you know, blown around by the wind, except for the little hummingbird. Those little guys are so tough. It was seemed to be going just where it wanted to, where some of the other birds were seemed like they were having a little bit of trouble.
Yeah, I guess they don't have as much wind resistance. There's not much to them. Oh, they're incredible. It's just incredible to watch them. They just toy with everything around them.
Yeah. Tough little buggers. So the breeding birds are back, right? Hummingbirds and a whole bunch of other ones.
Yeah, pretty much everything. I mean, not quite everything, but almost everything is back. Still a few things left to come in that come in later, like eastern woodpecker. But most of the things that we expect to see in our backyards are already back. And you know, they waste no time. They're getting down to business. Towhees have been back for a couple of weeks and they're already making nests. Great crested flycatchers came in the last week, and the orioles all seem to come in overnight, at least out where I am on the Outer Cape. On, I think, Thursday night of last week, it went from zero orioles at Wellfleet Bay Sanctuary to both Orchard and Baltimore orioles just being everywhere. It was just such a clear, you know, we went from zero to 60 with orioles in one night. And that's just how this time of year works. They just, you know, you just get a, yeah. You get a downpour of orioles one day and there they are.
Yeah. We had one on the apple tree the other day. My daughter was looking out the window and she's like, "What is that?" It was, you know, so pretty against the green leaves.
And they're intense.
Apple blossoms are just starting to come out. So yeah, they're really beautiful. And I have a little, house finch nesting in the wreath on my front porch. So I just took a little peek in the nest and I noticed that there's a little rabbit fur that they lined the nest with.
Yeah.
Which I saw on the front yard. So, you know, they got it out of the yard. Yeah. I don't know if there wasn't eggs in it when I looked there about a week ago, but there could be by now. I don't know.
Yeah, no, they nest really early. I think they have chicks already. There's a nest at the sanctuary in one of our outbuildings. Their house finches are very early nesters. Carolina wrens have chicks by now. I think some of the bluebirds have started hatching. So yeah, we're full into nesting season for the locals. We've got a cardinal nest that's just sort of hanging over our driveway that Beckett found. Uh-huh. You know, he was excited, and unfortunately it has two eggs in it. And that's it. And that's going to be the final total. And one of them is a cowbird egg.
Oh, no.
Yeah, the cowbirds have been bad. I saw a female cowbird trying to get into the nest box where my titmice are nesting out at the edge of my yard. And they don't typically parasitize. And so cowbirds, of course, they lay their eggs in the nests of other birds. They don't make their own nests. They're what's called obligate brood parasites. Ornithological speak. It's a brilliant strategy, I guess, but it's not great for the host species. And I was really surprised to see this female trying to get into this bluebird box, basically, where the titmice are nesting, and she wasn't successful. And typically they don't bother the cavity nesters, but they're, you know, they're out there right now. They know where every nest is. The female cowbirds are watching all of the local birds and they know exactly where they're nesting.
So
they got this cardinal.
Yeah. So what do you take that egg out? What do you do?
Yeah. I mean, you don't really need to intervene. It's very tempting to. I'm trying to, you know, cowbirds, I think, are technically protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. You know, do what you feel is right. I'm not going to say anything. But yeah, there's certainly a lot of cowbirds, and you know, it's not like cardinals are endangered or something like that. This is a native bird doing what it does.
Yeah, wow. And does cardinals normally only have a couple of eggs, or I mean, is that pretty common?
No, I would think they would have four, and my guess is that the female cowbird removed some of the cardinal eggs.
Wow. And so we still have May migration. Some, what are we expecting? What, warblers, tanagers? What are we looking at?
Sound more excited. Warblers, tanagers, buntings, they're coming.
I don't get the tanagers in my yard, so you know.
I don't get the tanagers. I know they're a little bit scarce, but you know, here on the Cape, as we know, it's cold, it's windy, things are leaf out later, and the birds don't necessarily want to be here. They want to be in Ohio. And if you watch the bird migration maps, the center of the country is always lit up this time of year. The birds really like to move right up through the middle of the continent, and that includes songbirds and shorebirds. It takes a bit of the right winds to get a good amount of birds here. It looks like we won't get those until maybe Saturday. We'll get some more southerly winds. But yeah, we don't always get what we want. But sometimes we luck out and we get good fallouts of warblers. And we get our steady trickle of warblers and tanagers and things like that. And we really look forward to it. And mid-May is typically when it peaks. And so we're not quite there yet. The first few warblers have been coming through. But, you know, they're just... there's a mystique about them. They don't breed around here, most of them. They're going further north, so they're just sort of passing through, and they're gorgeous, a lot of them. I mean, they're brightly colored, they're singing constantly. It's just this infusion of color and sound that we need right around now.
866-999-4626 is our number for your bird comment, questions, stories. We'll talk about other critters as well. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We've got an email from a listener in North Falmouth who says, we put up a screech owl box in a great location. Sure enough, a screech owl moved in midwinter. We would see it sunning its face in the little doorway each morning. But a few weeks ago, we stopped seeing the owl. I still hear screech owls hooting to each other near my house in the early morning. Questions, just three questions. Is the owl done with the nest box? What is the owl up to now? And if they had any babies, would we see them peeking out of the box?
Probably. it's interesting. Yeah, I don't know what that owl was doing in there. They're not nesting if it's just gone, unless they had a failed nest. I mean, there are different things that could have been happening. It could have just been using it as a roost, and maybe it didn't have a mate or didn't have a nest, and it moved somewhere else, or it had a nest. You would probably know if there was a nest. You would see two birds. If you were watching it enough, you would see two birds at the cavity at certain times. You'd see like a food exchange or something like that. So, yeah, I mean, just be patient. They might nest there eventually. I have an owl, screech owl box on my property, and this year was the longest it was occupied, and they, of course, didn't nest. They eventually left. I assume it was a female, and I know there were two around, but they just didn't see fit to nest in it, and they went somewhere else. But now that you've got that unoccupied nest box, you should consider selling it. I mean, it's probably worth $500,000 right now in this real estate market. So rent it, you know, do what you need to do.
Yeah, you're funny. So you sent me a link to this Cornell's bird cast, which is pretty cool. I clicked on it this morning. I guess it was goes county by county. Last night, it said we had like 2,500 birds migrating. Tell us a little about that. That is a cool little thing to check out.
Yeah, so BirdCast is this Cornell Lab of Ornithology website that is dedicated to bird migration and presenting tools for predicting what's happening with bird migration that the average birder can use to see, will there be a strong migration of songbirds in my region? You know, should I go out tomorrow morning? And so they have these maps, and a lot of it is based on radar data. The NEXRAD radar birds show up in the weather radar, and this has become a really well-studied phenomenon, and increasingly they're using it in models. And so, you know, they take real-time radar data showing bird migration, and they will convert it somehow into some metric of how many birds passed over your area last night. And they have these graphs and things. It's really cool. It's something new this year. They're always improving BirdCast. But the overall idea of it is like a weather report for bird migration. You know, like I said, cloudy with a chance of warblers kind of thing. Like, will I get bird migration in my region, you know, in the next few days or whatever? So it's a really, really interesting website and worth checking out. It's tough to predict our migration here on the Cape. It's kind of like our weather, you know, just like our weather is like impossible. You know, check back in 5 minutes if you want to know the weather. It's sort of like that here with bird migration, too.
Yeah. Let's talk to Robert, who's giving us a call from New York City. Hi, Robert.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Two questions, if I might. They're both concerning bird feeders. I'm counting down the days till I get up to Orleans, but while I'm here in New York City, I've got a kind of classic urban situation where I have a bird feeder on the fire escape. First question is, this time of year, I've been putting, you know, some mixed bird seeds in, and they'll go through, like, I don't know, it's about a little over, I guess, about a quart of bird seed in like less than 24 hours. So they're just like wiping it out. And frankly, I just can't keep up with them. So I was wondering, when a bird feeder is empty, so, you know, I see birds coming every day, so I figure they've got some kind of memory, they come back. Do birds, like, you know, plot their territory and memorize where these sources are? And I was just wondering if, you know, how many days empty when they come back and say, oh man, there's nothing here, and then leave. Are they just going to write it off and say, oh, never mind. I've got to cross it off my map because I've gone 3 days now and there's nothing there. I got to keep moving and keep looking. Is there any sort of, you know, how long is a feeder empty before the birds kind of write it off and stop visiting?
Before they quit on you?
Right, exactly.
I haven't seen any evidence that they quit on you. You know, if they sort of have a territory and they've evolved to take advantage of ephemeral food sources, right? There's no such thing in nature as a food source that's always there. That's not really true, probably, but you know, you get the idea. You know, okay, food sources come and go for wild animals, and they have to be ready to take advantage of them and then move on when it goes away. And bird feeders are just part of that. And it depends on the species, but I find I'm often pretty lazy about filling my feeders here in, you know, suburban kind of woodsy Harwich here. But And a lot of people, I think, have the same experience. It's been 2 weeks since the feeder had anything in it, and you go out and the chickadees are there in 30 seconds. And so they have a bunch of places that they're checking. You know, they have a mental map of where the food sources are in their breeding territory or winter territory or year-round territory, whatever it is. And you would just be part of that. You know, and they'll probably keep coming back and checking. And it's a good question what the giving up point is. You know, at what point would they stop checking it? Maybe never.
Right.
All they have to do is look.
Mark, do you think they follow? I mean, the chickadees are always the first ones there, right? So do they just, the other birds just kind of watch, let's see where the chickadees go. Because they're going to get they know where all the food is.
Yes.
Chickadees know.
Yeah, I think so. They're sort of like the leaders of the mixed flocks around here. And I think other birds know that the chickadees, they're not really migrating for the most part. And so they know where the year-round resources are. Like, oh, this is where you go when things freeze up to get a little bit of water. And so I do think that the birds keep an eye on them and take their lead from the chickadees.
Yeah. Robert, what's your other question?
Well, I this really isn't a question, but grosbeak, you pronounce the S in grosbeak or not? Is it grosbeak or grosbeak for a bird?
We say grosbeak.
Grosbeak, okay.
Yeah. We've anglicized it.
We've been seeing all kinds of birds, and down here it seems to be the sparrows or the scouts, because we haven't seen a single chickadee. Up in the Cape, we see all kinds of chickadees. Here it's the sparrows that seem to be leading the way, but we've gotten a couple kinds of woodpeckers, the blue jays come by, and the one that came that my wife and I, we both grew up in northeastern United States. Our entire lives, we've been casual and I look out the backyard, kind of bird people. Never seen it before it landed. I looked up, oh my God, I've got some exotic escape thing. Look it up and it said, oh, it's common. It was a rose-breasted grosbeak. And it's just a spectacular bird. But my wife and I, you know, longer than we care to admit, have never, ever, ever seen one before. But apparently they're like, the bird guys are like, oh yeah, it's in the Northeast. It's just they live high up in the trees. But we've seen as many as two at a time on this teeny tiny little bird feeder, and it's just the most amazing, spectacular, exotic-looking bird. It kind of blew us away how colorful it was.
Yeah, that's a good find. It's not it's not like a ho-hum thing, really. It depends on where you are. They like mature, rich forest, so they don't really breed so much here on the Cape. We hope to get them in migration. You hope to see one or two in migration, but they're not really common here. It's not something I would expect on a bird feeder in New York City as a common thing, but certainly they do pass through there in migration too. But it's not like a common ho-hum species, and they are spectacular looking. I was really excited to see some over Mother's Day weekend. We were off Cape up in, you know, up near the New Hampshire border in a town with really rich kind of swampy woods and big giant trees, very unlike here on the Cape. and they were there. So I was really happy to get my first rose-breasted grosbeak for the year on Sunday.
Yeah, Robert, thanks for the phone call. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Got a couple of questions. Really good question from Joe in West Harwich. He says, I've been watching an eagle cam set up at a nest in Hanover, Pennsylvania for the past several weeks. It's amazing. But as I watched the chicks, it dawned on me that while their parents bring them plenty of meals to eat, the adults cannot bring them water. It made me wonder if they simply get the water they need from the food they eat, or do they ingest water when it rains on the nest? I frequently observe the chicks with their beaks open and appearing to pant, especially on sunny afternoons. Then I thought of our local ospreys, which breed in the heart of the summer heat. Those chicks, like the eaglets, also have limited options to ingest water, and they're trapped in their nests during the hottest days of the year for many weeks. I guess I would just like to hear how birds, and particularly eagles and ospreys, get the water they need to survive when they are chicks.
That's a good question.
Yeah.
And do they ask for a glass of water right when they're supposed to be going to sleep?
Going to bed. That's right. I need some water.
I mean, obviously, they've evolved to get all the water they need from the food they eat. Because clearly they can't drink and they can't bring water to them. You know, there are different adaptations for that, desert birds and things. There are these birds called sand grouses in Africa and parts of Asia that live in the deserts, and they do this really cool thing where they fly many, many, many miles from where their chicks are to a water hole. And they have these specialized breast feathers that they can soak in water and then fly back to their chicks to bring them water. So there are environments where they do have to bring the chicks supplemental water. But for the most part, birds get the water they need. Chicks get the water they need from the food that they eat. Doesn't seem like it would be enough, especially when you try to raise human children, but that's how they've evolved, and that's how they do it.
And then he's got a PS. He says, a peregrine falcon nest on the Science Museum in Boston had 4 eggs, but was abandoned a week or so ago. Why would the falcon abandon what appeared to be a viable nest?
Yeah, there are different reasons. I don't know that in that particular case, but in some species, they'll abandon if one of the parents dies for some reason. If it's a species where both of them provide parental care, and so that's a common reason. You know, if there's a huge disturbance, I can't imagine that would be the case here. But often it's the death of one of the parents that does it. But it's hard to say without knowing the specifics.
All right, let's talk to Phyllis calling from Wellfleet. Hi, Phyllis.
There, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Great. So my hummingbirds are absolutely thrilling me. They're here and they are just gorgeous. But what I want to know is, what can I do to bring the orioles? I rarely see them, and I think they're spectacular to look at, and I'd love to attract them. So what can I do?
Yeah, well, so the standard thing is to put out a jelly feeder. That's the easiest thing. People put out orange halves. You know, it depends on the situation. It works for a lot of people. I've never had a ton of luck with it. Sometimes it has worked, but it seems like if you don't get it out at the right time, they find other food sources, or, you know, so now is the time to have one out. I put mine out, and okay, I mostly just get catbirds on it. you can try adding flowering trees like crab apples, tend to be an attractant for orioles, as Mindy was talking about earlier. They're really mm-hmm. drawn to those flowering trees in spring.
And about putting out slices of orange, or, you know, somebody said put out some quarters of oranges, get one of those feeders that has a spike on it so you can put some orange.
Quarters? Are oranges that expensive? Jeez, try a half an orange. Splurge a little. Come on, you really want an Oriole, don't you? Yeah, but like whatever, pieces of orange half. Yeah. I hear people say that works at first, and then they stop going to them after a while, and they just go to the jelly. You know, what they really need now is insects. And so the best thing for attracting all birds is to have a good variety of native trees and shrubs in your yard. And there are things you can add. You know, I mentioned crab apples, but things like chokeberries and, you know, keeping those oaks, because really what they're eating this time of year, again, is insects. They need caterpillars to feed their babies. And so thinking about retaining your native plants on your property and adding more, particularly trees and shrubs, is a really good way. But most people tend to think, oh, I put out a jelly feeder. And yes, that works. And that's a great way to see them. So do both.
Yeah, Phyllis, thanks and good luck.
The key, can I just say one more thing?
Yep.
So the key word that you just used is native, because I've been told lately that some of the plants that I've been buying, even in local nurseries, are not native plants, and that the birds need the native plants to feed off of, because they attract the right kind of bugs that the birds will feed off of. So your key word of native is, I think, really important, and I thank you for that.
Yeah. And Mark's very big on native plants.
You nailed it. I mean, and so there's kind of a movement there, and there's a guy named Doug Tallamy who's sort of the guru of this. He's an entomologist down at the University of Delaware who's put out several books about how to manage your yard in a way that benefits birds by benefiting bugs. And so that, and you hit on it, it's the native plants tend to attract and host a much, much bigger variety of native insects that in turn is what our birds feed on. It's what they feed their chicks. They need trees to be covered in lots of little caterpillars that they then feed to their babies. And that's sort of how things work. And so not spraying your trees, not using pesticides, planting more native plants, you know, all of these things benefit birds.
I was just going to say that spraying, you got to be careful, right? You know, we see a lot of these companies going around spraying for mosquitoes and ticks and whatnot. You want to be really careful and make sure you're not spraying your entire yard, because you're killing everything, right?
So, right, exactly.
All right. Cynthia says, wanted you to know that last week we had a male rose-breasted grosbeak for 3 days and our safflower feeder almost constantly, then gone. Our neighbor spotted a female yesterday, also a male indigo bunting for 2 days last month. See, good idea to keep your eye on those bird feeders.
Jeez, yeah.
Yeah, that's nice. Let's talk to Gail, calling from somewhere in the Mid-Cape. Hi, Gail.
Good morning. I have a question about a strange, unusual behavior for us with bluebirds. I live in Rhode Island. I'm on the Cape right now, but I live year round in Rhode Island. And we, over the last several years, have had an abundance of bluebirds. This year, we hung another box because a couple of weeks ago, a pair kept flying, not banging into the window, but flying into the window like they wanted to come in. So I took down a little wren house that I have hanging on the back porch, and I replaced it with a bluebird house, thinking that that was the reason. They kept flying in and out of the house, and it wasn't a cavity house. So I took it off, and I put the cavity house up, and it seemed as though they were going in there. But this behavior of coming to the window, they come to the window now where the dishes are, where I wash the dishes, and he'll sit right on the windowsill and peck at the window. And it's gone way down. The behavior, it was constant, like from daybreak to sunset, but it's now maybe two or three times a day. Have you ever seen this before? And do you have any idea why they're doing it?
With bluebirds, not so much. I mean, there are other more common things that do this, robins and cardinals in particular are famous for this. And,
yes.
And typically they're seeing the reflection and they think it's other birds. You know, they're not the brightest creatures in the world. They're lovely. You know, they're good looking. Can't have it all.
Beautiful.
right. But But yeah, I think that if they're tapping on windows, then they probably, they think they're seeing other bluebirds and maybe they're being territorial. But yeah, it's really interesting to hear this behavior from bluebirds. It's not, I don't think that's a species I've heard this reported from before. So thanks for reporting that.
This is brand new. It's brand new behavior for us. And we have a lot of bluebirds. I've been putting out mealworms, the little suet balls. And so, you know, over the last several years, we have gotten multiple pairs, but this is the first year they've done this. So, so you think it's territorial and it's, that's what they're doing. They're trying to prevent other bluebirds just from the window reflection.
Sure. Or, are you generally a happy person? Or you think,
yeah.
I mean, maybe they just want to land on your shoulder and whistle a happy tune. I mean, maybe you're just the lucky one. I mean, but a lot of people would love to have a bluebird trying to get into their house.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Gail. Appreciate that. Okay. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Susan says, should we put our feeders and bird baths away due to the concern over avian flu? How about hummingbirds? Are they affected? Lots of advice from bird experts now say do not feed or water.
Yeah, you know, you really don't have to worry about songbird. I mean, it's just so the excuse me.
If you have chickens, maybe, right? If you have chickens,
it's a big deal if you have poultry. You know, and it was affecting waterfowl here on the Cape, and so we had the first case of highly pathogenic avian influenza (HPAI) back a couple of months ago with some Canada geese in Wellfleet. And then they subsequently confirmed it in some sanderlings, some gulls, some ducks, I think, and some raptors. And so it's been a problem in those groups of birds, but excuse me, it's declined since then. And it's never really in much of an issue for songbirds, if at all. You know, maybe they can carry it, but they're not symptomatic. And if Massachusetts does not issue a take down your feeders advisory, then I wouldn't worry about it, because, you know, Mass Wildlife is sort of anti-bird feeding overall because of different problems they perceive them causing with bears and things in other parts of the state. And so they look for, you know, any reason to tell you to take down your bird feeders, but they haven't. And it, you know, songbirds are generally okay when it comes to bird flu. I'm not aware of any outbreaks. And I have seen take down your feeder advisories in other states. I'm not sure what it was based on. You can always just say out of an abundance of caution to justify any kind of thing like that, but there's no real evidence that you need to.
Okay, let's talk to Rich calling from East Falmouth. Hi, Rich. Rich, are you there?
Rich,
okay, maybe we lost Rich. Let's try Earl in Brewster. Earl, are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right. Hi, Earl.
I've wondered for the longest time what the year-round birds do on the Cape in the dead of winter when it's so cold. Even yesterday with fierce winds, they were out there singing. But in the winter, I'm wondering where they go.
Yeah.
Maybe the ones that stick around, because we know some of them leave. But what about the ones that stick around?
You sound like you originated somewhere where it's a little warmer in the winter. The Cape is considered quote warm during the winter compared to other you know, the mainland, for example, because we don't get below freezing as much, and you know, we don't have as much ice over, and so there's fresh water. And so you think about it, there are birds in Barrow, Alaska in the middle of winter, right? There are birds in Antarctica. So different species are adapted to their different conditions, and they have their ways of dealing with the cold. And, you know, I think that's what you're asking here. And so they have to eat. They have their insulating feathers as their first line of defense. And then they have to eat. If they have to find food to stoke the furnace, to keep their metabolism up, and that's what gets them through the winter. It's been well studied in chickadees. They have to do other common sense things like seek shelter, get out of the wind, you know, drop their metabolism to survive the night. But the reality is hummingbirds can survive the night most of the way through the winter, if not all the way through the winter here in Massachusetts, if they get enough food. And so that's the kind of the best illustration of how that is the thing of paramount importance for birds surviving cold winter nights. It's just get out of the wind somewhere and have enough fat on you to shiver your way through the night and make sure you wake up the next morning. And they don't always, you know, if they don't get enough food, they don't wake up the next morning, because that's how it is. But chickadees can, I'm trying to remember the numbers here, but they can increase their body weight by at least 10% over the course of a day and then lose that 10% overnight. And then, you know, repeat. They just sort of do that on repeat on cold nights throughout the winter. So it's really interesting. They're just very different than us, very much adapted to be able to survive the cold.
It's a tough life for a little bird. Earl, thanks for the phone call. Yeah, Caitlin's calling us from Chatham. Hi, Caitlin.
Oh, it's not Chatham. It's Chilmark.
Oh, sorry. Chilmark. Go ahead, Caitlin.
I think I miss a part about growing native plants for bird or the insects that would feed the birds, but I just wanted to report one thing is that most of my bumblebee queens, when they come out in the spring, they're on non-native plants. Like, that's the first thing they go for, and they kind of stay on it. So, you know, I know we're supposed to plant native plants, but I'm just like rooting for like the lamium and the gill over the ground. And then last night I was walking along the Shining Seed Path or whatever, and near Woods Hole, it was like blowing and cold and horrible. And on a barberry, I saw three bumblebee queens. That was the only thing they were going for. It was really cool. Like in the middle, it was like, and they were there.
Yeah, I guess we should plant more barberry. No, this is an important point of discussion. No. You can't build your philosophy around what bees go to, because they'll go to anything. And it's not about what flowers bees go to. It's about supporting all of the insect herbivores that are eating the leaves. So all of the hundreds of thousands of species of moths whose caterpillars feed our birds, all of the beetles, all of the katydids, all of the things that prefer to eat the leaves and other parts of our native plants. Yeah, bees, butterflies, and hummingbirds will go to anything. Any non-native thing.
Okay.
And Japanese Andromeda. And so we all go through this, those of us who are like getting really into this whole native plant thing. And you're like, the bees go to whatever. And like, yeah, there's bumblebees in Europe and Asia. There's nothing wrong with those European and Asian plants that dominate our landscape and our nurseries from their perspective. It's just, I need nectar and pollen is all they're thinking. But it's really about the full range of diversity of insects that really prefer to eat the native plants, and that's what supports our birds. But yeah, bees will go to anything.
Caitlin, thanks for that observation and for giving us a call. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Marilyn, go ahead. We want to say something?
I just wanted to quickly make another point. It's hard to convey the complexity of nature and these little sound bites I'm giving here. But I said, bees will go to anything. The generalist bees will go to anything, like eastern bumblebees or what we all see in our yards, two-spotted bumblebee. We see like the couple of common bumblebee species that are left, and they visit any flower, native, non-native. But there are lots and lots. There are 4,000 species of native bees, and there are lots of them that are pollen specialists on certain kinds of native plants. And so that's another reason to plant natives, is to support all of these cool specialist bees that maybe only the females only use pollen from, you know, hibiscus or from sunflowers or from rudbeckias to make their nests. And so it's not, you know, there are certainly the common bees that we see every day are pretty much generalists, and that's why they're common. But there are lots of specialist bees, and just another reason to think about planting more natives.
All right, Marilyn in Chatham writes, back in 2019, we put up a screech owl box, and beginning in October 2020, a gray phase owl started using it. We saw him or her poking its little head out nearly every day. I know a squirrel took it over for a little while late last summer, but soon after the owl was back, or possibly a different one, but also gray, not red, We've only seen one owl, so not a nest, but it's been going on a long time, so I'm curious if they would move to a different nest box or tree cavity if they were going to nest. I mean, different from the place they've used as a roost.
Right. So this is sort of that same question as before. Yeah, so they'll have multiple cavities. Like cavity nesters, they know the local real estate. They know what's around. It's not just like they're in your box and they're in there forever. You know, they reserve the right to sell and upgrade and whatever. And if they're not nesting, you know, there might be things that happen that you don't see that scare the owl out of there. So it's hard to say. There are a lot of reasons that they could choose to be another place. But once they're nesting, they'll stay there for the most part, unless something catastrophic happens. But it just seems like there are a lot of owls that maybe are not nesting, or, you know, they didn't secure a mate, or they're young or whatever. And they're in a roost for a while, in a cavity for a while, and then they'll move somewhere else for mysterious reasons.
Yeah. We happened to be talking about snowy owls last night, and young little Jackson at 7 years old says, yeah, they come every 4 years. I'm like, what do you mean they come every 4 years? And he said, you see them every year, at least some. He goes, no, you're wrong. It's every 4 years. I'm like, where did you hear that? Wildcrats. But I looked it up, and evidently snowy owls do travel south every 4 years, but there's some disagreement among experts on that.
Wildcrats said that? We're a big Wildcrats household.
Well, that's what he said.
So I was hoping he
usually
was going to say.
Guys are right. Yeah.
I hope he was going to say he heard it from me. I learned it from Scott Weidensall from Project Snowstorm. And so that's the project that came out of the big snowy owl year that we remember here, 2012, 2013, I think it was. But yes, there is a 4-year cycle of lemmings in sort of Arctic Quebec. And every fourth year, it works. Like, we get more than average snowy owls down here. And I went back through eBird and looked at it, and it was exactly right. And so this past year was not huge, really, but this was the fourth winter. And so we did see more than usual, but it didn't turn out to be like a monumental year, but more than average. And that was true in 20.
What you can learn from those Wildcrat brothers, right?
Yes.
Martin and Chris. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Let's talk to Betty Ann calling from Chatham. Hi, Betty Ann.
Hi there. My question is about ospreys and their nests. And I live very close to Route 28 in the Riders Cove Boatyard area. And there are three towers that go up. And two of the towers every year have a nest on them. The third one never has a nest. Now, I've lived here for 40 years, and I cannot remember ever seeing a nest on that third tower. And I just wondered why. My thinking is, on that tower, they've placed a plastic box, like the type you'd see in a grocery store that you might haul milk in.
It's a milk crate, yes.
Yes, a milk crate. They've placed that at the top of the tower. If they took that down, I think they might get another nesting pair of ospreys. Is that possible?
Maybe. I mean, so the densities are going up, and I know exactly. I drive by there all the time. It's like 5 minutes from my house. But those are famous osprey nests, and there are typically three there. And then in recent years, there's the one a little up the road that was on the power on the lines, but then they put up the pole for it. Three seems to be the magic number of ospreys for Riders Cove. And more than one year, I think they nested on that antenna that's up Old Comers a little bit. But anyway, I mean, the ospreys could easily remove the milk crate. I don't know what the deal is with the milk crate, but they have so many other options there that they probably just don't bother.
Why doesn't Audubon take it down so that there's Audubon. A space for them?
We have nothing to do with that area. We don't own that.
Oh.
I don't know who manages those towers. They probably don't want an osprey nest on every one.
All right, Betty Ann, thanks for the call. Let's get an update now on the Falmouth Osprey Project. Tell us a little bit about that. What's going on?
Oh, yeah. This has been a fantastic project, and hopefully it can be a model for how to deal with this issue in other towns. And the issue is ospreys, you know, the population has been increasing exponentially for years, and the highest densities are Bourne, Falmouth, you know, Mashpee into Barnstable, densities that we don't see anything near that here on the Outer Cape where I am. And so, you know, increasingly they've been nesting on electrical poles, that causes fires. The nest, you know, bridge between the two energized wires, and the nest catch on fire, you know, kills chicks. Adult birds die quite a bit. So it's a problem for the birds. It's a problem for people who need electricity. And so, you know, we've been talking, we being Mass Audubon, you know, me and others for years, been talking to Eversource about this and, you know, trying to get them to put up more alternative poles. And it's just not something they're able to do a lot. The other thing we've been talking about is getting deterrents that work. A lot of the deterrents they've used over the years have not worked. And so the ospreys will just keep building on top of it, or they'll just move the next pole down. So the strategies have not been working to keep the ospreys safe or to keep the power on. And so Eversource has made a lot of progress on this. And I think a big part of that was what happened in Falmouth last winter, where they removed a bunch of nests and they didn't put up deterrents or alternative poles. And so the ospreys came back, and then there were a lot of fires and outages, foutages. But this guy named Kevin Friel has been the catalyst for this osprey project in Falmouth. And he was looking to photograph all the ospreys, and he quickly got overwhelmed. He said, good Lord. And there are over 120 pairs of ospreys just in Falmouth. I think we're up to 135. And it's really just Kevin is doing this, and with some help from others. A woman named Barbara Schneider got involved, and they formed like a little nonprofit, basically. And they've had a ton of community support. And the idea was to identify the problem nests, communicate with Eversource, and their part of it was to get deterrents up, like those half culverts seem to work really well, those half corrugated plastic pipes. And then to negotiate with landowners to get an alternative pole put up nearby. You know, and it wasn't easy. The ospreys are stubborn. They're like, oh, thanks for the alternative pole. I'm going to go nest back on the power lines. Thank you. And so sometimes you have to put up another deterrent, the next pole down, and then another, you know, and they're still trying. But overwhelmingly, it's been successful. They put up 20 alternative nesting poles and platforms in an unbelievably small amount of time. I've just been shocked by this little community project. And it's been very, very successful. A couple of examples where it was tough to get one sighted in the right place and it's maybe not working out, but overall it's been a fantastic success. They had a festival, not this past weekend, but the one before, there in East Falmouth. A lot of people came out, and just a really great story. Yeah. And so overall, we've got better communication with Eversource. For Eversource's part, they put up a website for Cape Cod ospreys, specifically about ospreys on power lines. And they have an email address now, osprey@eversource.com. And they're very responsive. I know, you know, I've been meeting with the people who get those emails. I know who they are, and they're very much on this now and very responsive to it. And so a lot of progress on this front in the last year, and in no small part thanks to this Osprey project in Falmouth with Kevin and Barbara.
Yeah. Mike in Centerville says, what about making a plug for No Mow May, where you let your grass grow for the month of May, allowing the pollinators to have something to eat when they come out of hibernation until the other flowers appear? I never heard of that before, No Mow May.
Yeah, I've been seeing more and more about this on social media. You know, I belong to a lot of groups on Facebook that are like Northeastern pollinator gardening and that kind of stuff. Mm. And so I get a lot of the same stuff. But yeah, No Mow May. I don't know how this relates to Movember. Isn't Movember a thing? Do we mow more in Movember? Oh, no, that's about something else, I think. No Mow May. So I love the idea of it. And so, you know, the worst possible version of a lawn is just the chemically maintained, kind of sickly, too green, nothing growing in it except European turf grass, you know, no weeds. It, you know, in a lot of cases, the weeds are really beneficial things like like violets and, you know, and other things. And so the idea is to just let the lawn go, let some flowers go, support some bees, even though most of the weeds in a lawn are not native either. It doesn't matter. I mean, it's better than not having anything, but European turf grass in your lawn, having a little more biodiversity, letting it go a little bit and, you know, supporting bees and other insects in that way. It's a great idea.
Good idea. Yeah. All right. Whales and seabirds, Race Point is just always the hot spot, isn't it?
Yeah. Particularly the last half of April. Race Point, you know, there's a reason for it. There's deep oceanic water that gets pretty close to shore, right there near Race Point Light there. And so the birders make the considerable effort to get out there and hang out there and in hopes of seeing rare seabirds and just seeing the whole spectacle of all the seabirds going by. But this spring, you know, the right whales were putting on a great show there. And it's not predictable. Right. It's not, you know, Stormy Mayo doesn't know. And this birder, Peter Flood, who's there more than anybody, and he reports his whale sightings. He takes pictures of them and reports them to the Center for Coastal Studies. So he's sort of like a de facto whale researcher because he's there for the birds. And so sometimes the right whales are there and they're just showing right off the beach there. But there have been, there was at least one day or a couple of days where they were seeing sei whales, sei, S-E-I,
right, yeah,
which is a pretty rare kind of whale you typically wouldn't expect to see around here. There's this fast, sleek, they're very closely related to fin whales, which we see a lot more commonly. And, you know, and minkies and humpbacks were around. So just a real diversity of whales out there, in addition to the incredible seabird show that you get to see out at Race Point. And it was certainly like that during April. I don't know if it's tapered off. I haven't seen the right whale reports from out there quite so much lately, but always worth checking.
Off. Yeah. Usually May they start going right away. I haven't looked either. So I wouldn't think there'd be a lot of them anyway. All right. So we want to make sure we mention Birdathon coming up this weekend, right?
Birdathon is coming up, yes. Mass Audubon's big fundraiser / birding competition. You know, it's goes from 6 p.m. Friday to 6 p.m. Saturday, and all of the different regions have a team, and we compete against the other regions within Mass Audubon. We're all trying to raise money, so support your local Birdathoner, support other organizations that are doing these kinds of things. But yeah, check us out. If you know anybody doing it, make sure to support them as they try to support their local sanctuaries and all the work we do. It's good stuff. Yeah. It's good fun.
And lastly, in the last minute or half, we have the spring shorebird migration. We're seeing some shorebirds returning as well.
Yes, we do get a spring shorebird migration. It's not like it is in late summer and fall. We get the biggest number of shorebirds in southbound migration after they breed in the Arctic. But we do get a spring migration. And the good part about it, it's not as big, not as many species, but we get to see them in breeding plumage. So you get to see what these Dunlin and Sanderlings that have been here in their gray winter plumage all winter, you get to see what they look like when they're up breeding on the Arctic. And the Dunlin have a nice black belly and a nice reddish back. And then the ruddy turnstones are just gorgeous when they're in breeding plumage. And you can see them gathered in flocks and salt marshes behind barrier beaches as it gets later into May. Black-bellied plovers are in their breeding plumage and they're around, semi-palmated sandpipers. So don't dismiss the spring shorebird migration. You know, it's there and it's worth checking out. It's just not quite the numbers that we see later in the summer, but good-looking birds, worth seeing.
Yep. Keep your eyes out. All kinds of birds we can be checking out this time of year. Mark Verity, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary, joins us the second Tuesday of each month. Thank you, Mark. Thanks for being here.
All right. Catch you next time.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.